NPR's Only a Game. Today, we'll go back 100 years to look at the career of the first black world champion cyclist, Major Taylor. And we'll hear from the most recent black cycling champ, Al Whaley, why so few have followed in Taylor's footsteps. First, 100 years ago, Marshal Major Taylor became a professional bike racing champion, an exceptional accomplishment for an African-American facing constant, sometimes violent, racial abuse. A century later, efforts are underway to honor this champion. Only a Game's Ken Shulman has this report.
Category 68.
Bike racing was one of the first big sports. Every bit as big as boxing, every bit as big as baseball.
Richard Fries is editor of The Ride, a bicycling magazine. A former racer, Fries is manning a booth at a Sunday bike swap in Brookline, Massachusetts. Major Taylor is the honoree here. A lecture on his life is scheduled at noon. Afterwards, Major Taylor's great-granddaughter will receive a plaque commemorating his 1899 World Championship season. Two booths down, members of the Major Taylor Humanitarian Society hawk T-shirts and posters to help raise funds for a statue of Major Taylor that will be erected in Worcester, Massachusetts, where Taylor spent most of his adult life. Again, Richard Fries.
This is an era when bike racers were really the premier athletes of the day, bringing down the largest salaries and commanding some major audiences, filling Madison Square Garden. And here's a guy who's the world champion, and to see what he had to overcome in terms of racing, it's just fascinating.
In 1878, Marshal Walter Taylor was born into a family of 10 on the outskirts of Indianapolis. His grandparents had been slaves. His father fought in the Civil War in an all-black regiment on the Union side. When Marshall was 9, his father found employment as a coachman with the Southards, a wealthy white Indianapolis family. The Southards' 9-year-old son Daniel became Marshall's best friend and playmate. In his autobiography, Major Taylor recalls how he got his first bicycle.
The rest of Dan's playmates were of wealthy families, too. And I was not in the neighborhood long before I learned to ride a bicycle just as they did. All the boys owned bicycles, excepting myself, but Dan saw to it that I had one too. I soon became a big favorite among them, perhaps because of my ability to hold up my end in all the different games we played, such as baseball, tennis, football, roller skating, running and cycling, trick riding, and all the rest.
Marshall and his father left the Southards when he was 14. He did get to keep the bicycle, though. A local bicycle merchant who saw Marshall doing bike tricks on the street hired him to sweep floors in his shop and to perform for the customers every afternoon. He dressed Marshall in a uniform with shiny brass buttons and a military cap. Soon, the young acrobat became known as Major. In 1882, Taylor's employer entered Major in his first bike race, which he won.
In 1894, blacks were officially banned from racing by the League of American Wheelmen, then the governing body of the sport.
Lynn Tolman is a member of the Major Taylor Humanitarian Committee, a volunteer group spearheading the effort to build a Worcester statue. Major Taylor was such a brilliant rider, she explains, that the league had no choice but to make an exception for him.
When he was ready to turn pro around 18, though, the racing board of the League of American Wheelmen allowed him to race. He was hot, he was popular, he was big box office.
Major Taylor was admitted into the ranks of professional racing, not as an equal, and not forever. The league rescinded his membership twice between 1897 and 1900. On the road, Taylor was denied seating in most restaurants and lodging in many hotels. On the track, white riders conspired against him. In one race, which Taylor won, a white rider dragged him off his bike after the finish line and choked him until he was unconscious. Still, in 1898, Taylor set 7 world records. In 1899, he won the world championship by beating the world's best riders in Montreal.
I shall never forget the thunderous applause that greeted me as I rode my victorious lap of honor around the track with a huge bouquet of roses. It was the first time that I had triumphed on foreign soil, and I thrilled as I heard the band strike up the Star Spangled Banner. My national anthem took on a new meaning for me from that moment. I never felt so proud to be an American before. And indeed, I felt even more American at that moment than I had ever felt in America.
Major Taylor would also have won the 1899 U.S. Championships, but too many tracks on the Southern Circuit refused to let him compete. In 1901, he sailed the ocean for a four-month triumphal tour of Europe. In France, Taylor was received as a hero, hailed on the streets and feted in the finest cafes. Parisians thronged to the Parc des Princes, paying for the privilege of watching the 22-year-old black American pedal through his workout. They called him Le Nègre Volant, the Flying Negro. Taylor defeated the best racers on the continent. He was so popular that postcards bearing the address Major Taylor, Paris, France, were delivered daily to his door. It was the climax of his athletic career. Taylor continued his travels, circling the globe twice in the next 2 years. In December of 1903, he was met by a flotilla of fans in the harbor of Sydney, Australia. People shouted out his name through megaphones. Banners bearing his name were strung from mast to mast. But Major Taylor was not welcomed with open arms everywhere he traveled. In January, while stopping in San Francisco on his way home to Massachusetts, he was refused a table at a restaurant because of the color of his skin. It was incidents like these that in part inspired Taylor to write his autobiography. He considered the struggle to be more than personal.
Judging by the manner in which colored athletes have repeatedly demonstrated their skill and prowess in the athletic world, it is quite obvious what might well be accomplished on a whole as a race in other pursuits of life if granted a square deal and a fair field. We ask no special favor or advantage over other groups in the great game of life. We only ask for an even break.
I do identify with him because at the time when he was racing, there was hardly any blacks in the sport of cycling.
Al Whaley was world champion bicycle track racer in 1997 and 1998. He was the first African-American to win the title since Major Taylor, whom it is said he resembles in riding style and tactics. A high school track and football star, Whaley started racing bikes when he was nearly 30.
I didn't realize there were bike races until 1989, and that's when Greg LeMond won the Tour de France. It was on Wide World of Sports, and I thought, wow, that is so cool. And that was like an inspiration to me to start racing, and that's why I started racing in 1989.
Major Taylor turned pro half a century before Jackie Robinson entered Major League Baseball. But unlike Robinson, whose through in 1947 opened the gates for African-American baseball players, Taylor's achievements did little to create similar opportunities in cycling. Today, there are virtually no blacks in the sport anywhere in the world. Whaley cites a few reasons.
They have no clue about bicycle racing, for one. Another is it's a very hard sport, and it's an expensive sport as well. And a lot of African-Americans look at baseball, football, basketball, the big three, and now golf for the quick buck, a career. And cycling isn't one of those on that top podium for them. They don't even think about it.
Basketball. Everybody plays basketball.
Why? How come everyone plays basketball?
Ray Walsh, can you play in school? You can't play baseball.
Bikes Not Bombs was founded in 1984 by a group of mechanics in Cambridge, Massachusetts. To date, the project has sent 15,000 bicycles to Nicaragua and set up 5 bike shops there. It does similar work in Haiti and the Dominican Republic. In Roxbury, the primarily black section of Boston where the project is housed, Bikes Not Bombs trains inner-city teenagers to work as mechanics in its repair shop. It also instructs them in bicycle safety and, in some cases, racing. Chris Huggins is a former racer who teaches them.
You know, I can never remember somebody saying, you know, wow, you're going to be a great cyclist in high school. You know, or a coach saying, that way, you know, you could really go far with this, or we could train you to do really well. It was all up to the kids. And they sort of said, all right, well, you know, now that you're into sports, put the bikes away and pick up a basketball.
At its annual meeting this June, 100 years after Major Taylor won his first and only world championship, the League of American Bicyclists officially apologized for its role in excluding Taylor from U.S. competition. While the League has at last come to terms with its past, it still has to determine the future of African-American athletes in cycling. League President Earl Jones.
It may very well be just that it takes some breakthrough presence in the sport, and then once that happens, I think you go on from there. You can almost kind of compare it to tennis in a way. Tennis has not been a sport where African Americans have had a significant presence until somebody gets involved and gets some celebrity prominent in the sport, and then it opened up the possibility of other people being involved. I think we look forward to the opportunity when someone does that in cycling.
Track racer Al Whaley agrees and adds that as a black cyclist, he feels an added responsibility each time he competes.
I mean, I've gone to races, and I've been the only African-American at a race. It's not the thing on the front of my mind, but it is in my mind that I want to do well because I want to let others see that we're okay in this sport, or we can do okay, but it takes work, but we can still do okay.
In Major Taylor's time, young men were drawn to cycling. Nearly 1,000 men competed on the professional circuit in velodromes that sprouted across the country. Fans screamed as they watched the men they called scorchers whip around the banked track at speeds in excess of 40 miles an hour. These scorchers were also highly paid. When Major Taylor retired from racing in 1910, he was one of the richest black men in America. But his fortune soon withered. A series of business failures bankrupted him, forcing him to sell off his possessions and, eventually, his home. As Major Taylor declined, so did the sport of track racing. The Depression and the exploding popularity of the automobile forced the closures of scores of velodromes. The sport of track racing all but disappeared. In 1930, a broken, ailing Taylor left Worcester for Chicago. For 2 years, he lived there at the YMCA, subsisting handouts and from the sporadic sales of his self-published autobiography, which he peddled doggedly door to door. In April 1932, Taylor underwent heart surgery. 2 months later, he died. His body lay unclaimed in the morgue of Chicago's Cook County Hospital for several days. After a week, he was buried in a common grave at public expense.
This was a monument that I did years ago, back in the early 90s. It was one of my first freestanding figures. It's not very big.
It's a Thursday night at the Worcester Public Library. Toby Mendez is one of the five finalists invited to present their designs for the Major Taylor Memorial to the selection committee. The memorial will stand outside, just beyond the entrance of the soon-to-be-renovated library. The idea was first proposed by the parishioners of Worcester's Second Baptist Church, who found inspiration in Taylor's story and the fact that the devoutly religious racer refused to compete on Sundays. Both the city council and the local biking community have embraced the project. The statue should be realized by the end of next year. Worcester is justifiably proud of its adopted son. Young riders still hear stories of how Taylor used to power his primitive bike up George Street, the foreboding Worcester Hill that still forces riders off their ultralight 18 or 27 speed two-wheelers. They also hear how Taylor never lost his temper on the track, how he met racism and injustice with solemn, quiet dignity. Again, Major Taylor from his autobiography.
When I am finally run off my feet and flattened by that mighty champion, Father Time, the last thought to remain in my mind will be that throughout life's great race, I always gave the best that was in me. Life is too short for a man to hold bitterness in his heart.
For Only a Game, I'm Ken Schulman in Worcester, Massachusetts.
You can share your comments with Only a Game by writing to us, care of WBUR-FM, 890 Commonwealth Avenue, Boston, Massachusetts, 02215. Or by emailing oag at wbur.bu.edu. Please let us know on which station you hear Only a Game and how to pronounce your name. You can leave comments on our listener line by calling 617-353-1860. Or you can visit Only a Game's website at www.onlyagame.org. You're listening to Only a Game.